What's up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And we got another bonus episode for you here with two amazing guests. They are the creators behind Absolute Green Arrow, which is coming out from DC Comics May 20th, 2026, first issue. It's going to be a big launch. Very excited to have them both here. Ladies and gentlemen, Pornsack Pichichot and Raphael Albuquerque, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thank you for having us.
Hello. I'm very excited to talk about this. Now, the Absolute line has been like very concrete for a while. It's been very tightly put together. We're getting two books at the same time. We're getting Absolute Green Arrow. We're also getting Absolute Catwoman is coming out, a miniseries. So obviously they're being very careful with this and putting a lot of passion and a lot of thought into, okay, what is this next going to be? So why was, from your perspective at least, why was Absolute Green Arrow the right next step for the line?
I don't know if it was the right. I don't know if I'm the one to answer why it was the right next step for the line. I think that's more like the bigger, like above my pay grade kind of thing. I was just really grateful it was available. Mm-hmm. It was to me. It was. If you're going to take a modern take of any of the characters, doing sort of like a modern day Robin Hood, considering a modern day Robin Hood that like is the character is known for pulling from social issues and all that, given what all of its themes are and given what this particular moment is, this felt like a very salient character to tackle a bunch of things that I am very interested in. And I think a lot of us are really interested in. And so to me, it was just like, oh, if you're going to do a modern take of any character, the most potentially explosive, the most potentially, you know, controversial would be the biggest live wire would be Green Arrow, just considering all the themes of the characters and how they resonate so deeply with where we're at right now. So for me, it was just like I was just glad it was available, and I was glad they let me. I think I've said this publicly before. I really didn't think they were going to let us do what we're doing. And it's kind of amazing to me that they're letting us run with fairly little restraints.
I just wanted to ask Raphael before we get like more into the meat of the book. Now, if I remember correctly, you were supposed to do Absolute Superman and then dealt with a couple of real life catastrophes. Thankfully, hopefully you're doing okay and things are going better now. But now you're finally on this title. Does that feel good to finally be joining the Absolute line? And are you doing okay, more importantly?
We are okay. Unfortunately, we had this real bad floods in my hometown back in 2024. And yeah, I was working on Absolute Superman for a while. We were doing what we call pre-production. We were like working on the designs and all the concepts and everything. And yeah, definitely broke my heart having to leave the project because I wasn't sure if I would be able to make it. Since my house was in a higher place and I was somehow safe from floods, we were struggling with the lack of power and water and all that. So gave me this sense of being sure if I would be have the ways to do the work. So on the end of the day, I just told my editor Chris Conroy that would probably for the best of the book to call someone else to just do it. I'm happy to see the direction the book went. Rafa Sandoval, who took who took the art duties, he's doing such a phenomenal work. And it's nice to see a little bit of what we did back before. That they kept a little bit of what I did on the book now. So I'm proud to be part of two books now.
Yeah. That's awesome. Now, when you approach a book like this in the absolute line, would you approach sort of the absoluteness of it first? This is for both of you. Or is it approaching the character first from a design and story perspective?
I think it was the character first. I actually, so much of this stuff kind of like synced up serendipitously that, and a little bit is part of my process too, that I actually don't remember what came first. It's the chicken or the egg. But so much for me was, how do you take a modern, for all intents and purposes, a modern day Robin Hood, take sort of that DNA of the character and how do you sort of apply it? And then you kind of put it through this filter. And then once I did that, I kind of found out it aligned with so much stuff that the absolute universe was already doing. It was very easy to sink it in. So much so that I have a bad recollection of, did I know that going in? Or like, did I know some of the stuff that was happening going in that affected it? But I'm pretty sure it came very lot. Like, I don't really know when that information came in. All I know is that if it did influence me, it did not influence me that changed where my instincts went. It aligned so easily that I actually can't recollect what started, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg, because so much of it came so very naturally. So that by the time we did integrate with, and I think this is why it made so much sense to introduce Oliver Queen and Absolute Evil, so much of what we're doing integrated so easily with the plans of the Absolute Universe. I actually don't have a very good recollection of, oh, did they mention this to me first and then I did that? Or did I mention that first and then they did that? It all just synced up. And I think it's because we're all kind of coming creatively from the same place.
Raphael, what about you? Do you start from a place where you're like, okay, how can I take this character and make him much beefier and much bigger? Or what's the actual process like?
Yeah, no, I think it's also about thinking about the character more than actually the line. So what I really loved about the Green Arrow, the new take of Green Arrow that Barnes had brought in, was, first of all, it was a horror book. And that by itself, it's nice for me because I feel very comfortable drawing horror things. But also how feasible that character would be in a real world in this using this approach, you know what I mean? So it felt right for nowadays having a Green Arrow like that, and also it matches what the Absolute Universe is about. It's definitely a greedier version of these characters. It's definitely an updated version of these characters for a newer generation. So I think, considering the world we're living now, which is somehow very crazy, it makes sense to have a Green Arrow that is like that. And that definitely clicked for me. So it just made sense. I bought the idea right when Katie Cubbert, our editor, emailed me. I was like super into it, right on.
That's awesome. I mean, I'm struck by you talking about how it's a horror book. It's set in the Absolute Universe, which is a universe crackling with evil energy, darker, and yet the villains of this book are ripped from our world headlines, essentially. Can you talk about that? You didn't feel like you needed to heighten those, because having read it and without spoiling, like, it is very horrifying just on the page, and then doubly so when you sit back and realize, I remember when that happened.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of it too was was just modernizing the character. I mean, the Green Arrow as a character, and you know, and so much of this takes inspiration. It so much of the book takes inspiration, but also like pulls little bits of like lore here and there from all like my favorite sort of Green Arrow stories and Green Arrow runs and all that kind of stuff. But so much of it is the guiding star behind what Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams did. And again, I wasn't alive during those times, but if you read that book, it feels like they just did a laundry list of like all the pertinent social topics that must have been going on that time, like in all those newspapers. And so that was the, that, you know, that was baked into the DNA of the character already. And so just to service that, again, the idea of taking that and making a modern day version of that, then it's also, you know, like, okay, so how do we do that? And then on top of that, it, you know, it, so much of it, it's funny because the I feel like the big take, you know, the big thing that's certainly grabby is the idea that he's a serial killer. But, you know, and to me, that was, how do you do a modern take? If you can stretch your imagination to believe in a world where billionaires seem to be able to do whatever they want and there is no legal consequence for it, you know, and
okay,
you
are, I'm listening.
Seems impossible.
Try to go with me here. And you're a guy with a bow and arrow. Like, what can you do to actually feel for them to be scared of you? Like, right? Like this day where they could, like, you know, you shoot them and they go to jail. Like, again, if you could believe a world like this exists, how scary is the possibility of, like, legal ramification? So then what could this character do that could actually be effective? And that's sort of when the serial killer sort of aspect goes into it. But then when you look back, and again, so much of this book is me realizing how bad my memory is. And so, like, I will, like, because I read all that Grell stuff, but then working on this, I went back and was like, oh, God, he killed, like, it's 80 issues of the Grell run. Mm-hmm. And he killed through those 80 issues. And it makes me wonder, like, what the hell was going on back then that they were so cool with him, like, just killing back in the 80s? Because he does it, he did it once and he was like, oh, I'm not doing it again. It was for like 80 issues of that pretty regularly in that run.
Isn't there an aspect, though, of the character? This is something that I'm sure comes up a lot, but there's an aspect of the character, like, well, he uses a bow and arrow to fight evil, but he does it very safely and respectfully.
Yeah. Well, it is a weird conversation that you have. It's like, he's a superhero with a bow and arrow. It's like, and you're like, oh, no, but you don't get it. A bow and arrow is just as deadly as a gun. He's like, oh, but he kills? Like, no, he doesn't do that. And then you're just like, well, then what are we doing with the thing then?
Yeah, it's mostly boxing gloves. That's what we got going on. Don't worry about it. I should probably just mention here, we've kind of touched on this, but just in case anybody doesn't actually know what the book is about, slight spoilers for the Absolute Evil special, but Oliver Queen is gearing up to take on these fellow billionaires. He dies. He dies in that issue. He's killed by this evil cabal of the people who are running the Absolute Universe. And this picks up after that with following this serial killer that we're talking about, who is taking down the billionaires, the people who potentially may have caused Oliver Queen's death or been related to it. And meanwhile, on the other end, and this has been mentioned in solicits, I believe, but we have Dinah Lance, also known as the Black Canary, who is looking into it, trying to figure out what's going on, who killed Oliver Queen, and she becomes enmeshed in this mystery. So flipping that to the other side then, I mean, I think I know the answer for the main universe, but from the Absolute Universe, why was it important to make Dinah our window character here?
I mean, I think one of the reasons why you can't do a book. Something I should learn from James Tynion is that if you're going to do a horror book, it's not a horror book unless you're coming from the perspective of the scared. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So if you were to do a book like this from the killer's perspective, it's just a different book. It's a crime book. It's a vigilante book. It's whatever the case may be. But if you do it from someone from the outside looking in, it is then suddenly it's a horror book. And it also gave us a very classic framework to work off of, which is giallos, slasher horror. And so that became like a very easy framework. And then as for why Dinah is, I just love that. I think Dinah's like one of the most underrated, under like explore. There's been so much done with her and so much great stuff done with her, but I think there's still so much more to do with her. And so getting a chance to write Dinah Lance was just a treat for me. And it made so much sense with the characters, the idea that, there was a second where I went back and forth of just being like, should we call this like Absolute Green Arrow versus Black Canary? I just love the idea of versus Black Canary. But then it does not roll off the tongue at all. Like it does the opposite of rolling off the tongue. So everyone was like, don't do that. I mean, yeah, she's a big part of the end, but like, it's a tongue twister in and of itself. that title. But yeah, I love Black Canary as a character. So there was always someone that needed to fit that place. And she was a character I loved. She fit the place very organically. And also her themes ends up being so much of what the book. It's actually amazing how much her themes as a character relate with his themes as a character in a way that I don't know has ever really been explored. And I'm really kind of jazzed that, and it's fun that we get to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it really helps. I really like the absoluteness of the book, the down bad nature of both Oliver being dead and Dinah's what's happened to her. I think really puts them in the same basket, and the fact that they are on opposite sides of life actually really helps bring them together in a way that you don't get when it's about the romance and the like, the love story. It feels much, much stronger, I feel like.
They really are like opposite perspectives of sort of the same thing. And they're really, the way I look at the book, it is kind of this question of like, when there's this world of like all this wrongdoing and you want to affect change, is there a right version and a wrong way to do that? And they're both, it's kind of like a conversation between, you know, these different perspectives. It's just the language of that conversation is a lot of dead bodies and violence and all that.
I mean, Raphael, from that, to continue on that sort of the train of thought, what's your take on a horror through art? Like, I will say there's some bloody gross stuff that happens in this book for sure, but do you show, do you not show? What is scarier from your perspective? How do you get horror through in terms of what you are depicting?
That's something me and Porn Sack would discuss during the making of the book. Although we show a lot of horror bodies and stuff, violence, I think it's probably the most effective way to show terror is through suspense, through expectation. So that's how, since The American Vampire, I tried to build my sequence this way. I tried to build tension through the pages and not necessarily show a gore thing, but try to make the reader foresee that in a way that's very impressive for them. And we did that a lot. We Pornsack was very smart on the writing of it, and I think we were able to do a lot of really cool sequence where tension was built, and the reader is a very important part of you know the storytelling in this book, much more than just showing dead bodies all over, you know.
Yeah. Well, and let me say, it's very effective. The gore and stuff is great, but the stuff that was more horrifying for me is seeing the transformation of the character, the villains, I guess you could call them, in over the course of the first issue. You see people transform over time, and then in a couple quick moments where one villain character goes from being like pretty regular to being an absolute monster, and that was the sort of breathtaking moments for me that were super horror. And that dual horror where you're like, it's up here and it's sort of in the gut. I was like, this book is getting dark. It feels, I'm on a path toward darkness. It feels
like. Thank you. And yeah, I want to say too. Yeah. And I want to say too, I mean, Rafa's horror instincts are so assured and sort of confident. Like I remember when we first started, I was like, will we be able to show everything? Like, I think in my very, very early pitch, I'm like, is this a red band? But like, how do we show all this stuff? And Rafa was like very confident very early on. It's just like, we'll be able to do, like, don't worry about it. We'll be able to do everything you want to do. And we'll be able to get it through standards and practices. Like, you know, like I know how to handle this. And he was 100% right.
Yeah. On the other end of the spectrum, on the writing end though, and you touched on this a little bit earlier, but can you make an anti-establishment comic book for a company that is part of one of the largest entertainment companies in the world?
Yeah. Oh, that's a really, that's going to be a really good question. Yeah, that's a really good question. I will tell you my personal philosophy. Yeah. Keep all your single issues. You never know when something might disappear.
That's so funny.
Like, I'm keeping my comps. You know, 10 years from now, when all of a sudden, like, oh, creative differences and a trade can't exist anymore. I don't know how that happened. Like, I'm keeping all my physical, like, I'm glad this is not a digital. I'm glad we're not streaming. This is a physical media thing. And so we will find out the answer to your question.
Wow, that's the most horrifying answer. Yeah, what you just said. You really are backing the book all the way.
Yeah, it's so funny.
Another big aspect of the book is who is this serial killer? Obviously, or probably obviously, it's not Oliver Queed because we see his dead body at Absolute Evil as well as in this issue. But without, I'm not like plugging for like what number do you reveal it so much as how do you pace out a who is in the mask mystery so it doesn't test the audience's patience, hopefully?
I think that is a really good question. The answer is... Well, the answer is how do you pace it and how do you pace it well? I won't know the answer to that until we get to issue 6 and we'll see what everyone thinks. But hopefully along the way, and I think this is true for any kind of murder mystery, it's the friends we meet along the way. It's the fiends we meet along the way. It's the suspects that, you know, that we meet that hopefully are interesting enough that we are never felt like frustrated by the fact that, oh, we're going here, we're going there. And for this particular book, the suspects are, you know, for all intents and purposes, the myriad archers of the DC universe who have been found their way into the absolute orbit. And hopefully you will find them as interesting. I mean, so much of this book is just because you don't see Oliver Queen's face on every page doesn't mean this book isn't about the effect of Oliver Queen and the effect of this billionaire who wants to do good and the ramifications and the ripple effects his life has and his death had. And so hopefully, even if you don't know any of these characters, what you'll find interesting is how the life or death of Oliver Queen affected them. And if you do know these characters, it's hopefully even more fun to see characters that you recognize from the DC universe reinterpreted in a new way.
Yeah. I mean, part of the Green Arrow-like mythos is, yes, all the political action, the billionaire, the sort of Batman, Bruce Wayne-style origin, but with a bright spin on it. Like, he's always out there. He has the goofy arrows and whatnot. And it feels like that's an important part of the character. And I feel like we see that a little bit in the flashback where he is a bit of a goof, if I may say. Is that something you're going to continue through? Is that a thread that continues through?
I think part of what the book is about and part of, I think, what the Absolute line is about is when you take these tenets and these principles of idealism and heroism, How do they survive in sort of this darker world? And in Absolute Green Arrow, that is, it's in a way almost an existential question. It's, you know, it's how do these characters go on in this world that they live in, knowing what they know of the world that they live in, knowing what they see in the news every day. I think that's one of the central, it's definitely one of the central tensions as I'm writing it. And it's one of the reasons why I don't even know if I wanted to write it for that reason. I knew I wanted to explore it, but I'm definitely grateful to have written it for that reason, because so much of the central, you know, and this is something me and Rafa talk about a lot. It's why what we bonded over when we started the book is a lot of the questions at the heart of the book, serial killer aside, is stuff that I think I'm wrestling with on sort of like a day-to-day.
Hard same. Yes.
You know? And so much of this book is me sort of working out on the page how me looking for a way to kind of get through it. And I didn't know this going in, but I'm super grateful for the book that, again, I can't say this for everyone, but for me, it helped me find a light at the end, or something. It helped me find something to just latch onto a little bit.
And now you're out there killing billionaires, I believe.
Yes.
This is the lightest of all possible spoilers, but Justin kind of touched on it before. We do get to see Oliver Queen a little bit in flashback. Raphael, I wanted to ask you about one sequence in particular where we see him at three different ages with different hairstyles at different time periods. Having no artistic talent at all, I found that very impressive to progress somebody through time in such a concrete space on the page. How do you tackle something like that?
Well, thanks. I'm glad it worked out. I don't know. I think it's all about trying to figure out a way to keep the core, the visual core of the character recognizable. And then what I do is trying to play with the time they were living at. I mean, I think, I don't know, but I think that the early days of Green Arrow on the I forgot the name of the company, but anyway, the Green Arrow.
Green Arrow Trading.
On the Green Arrow's beginning of the website and stuff, it was like early 2000s or something. So I was like looking at reference and how we did look back there and try to adapt, you know, Oliver Queen's look into that to make it plausible, but also recognizable. So that was it. I mean,
yeah. Another art aspect that I thought was very interesting is not a lot of the book, but some of the book at least is told through phones, through news footage, things like that. As an artist, again, how do you make sure that that's visually dynamic, so it's not just like six panels of a face on a phone and that's all you're getting?
It was not so. It was probably more instinctive than something I gave a thought on. But what we were trying to do is recreating classic screams from our, you know, daily basis, internet. So we were trying to recreate, you know, TikTok and YouTube, all that. How try to mimic their screams and you know, in a way, trying to figure out a composition that work it out in a page, but that work it out in a very in a much more instinctive way than actually planned thing.
Yeah, one thing that I actually really appreciated about that, Pornsack, I'll throw out to you, is normally it'd be kind of annoying, to be frank, when you see modern social media in a comic book because it was created a year ago, 2 years ago, it doesn't feel of the times. But this actually felt very current. At least part of that was, I think, unless it was just my copy leaving out the logos, so there wasn't, we weren't looking like Clip Clop and Booty or whatever. But how, when you're writing something like that, knowing it's going to be a while until the comic book comes out, I imagine a little bit of it is luck. But how do you make sure that it still does feel like of the time?
I mean, I think a lot of what you just said is part of it. Is just like, logos, the fake logos definitely, I feel like, always throw people out, or at least always throw me out when I'm looking at it. But for me, it was less about like, how do I make this current, and more just sort of like, and I did this with my first book in 2018 on Infidel, is how do we just acknowledge like what media is now? And like, because for me, it was just like, you know, I find that in comics, so much of it is like, oh, I was walking by a TV. And I'm like, when was the last time any of us walked by a TV? Like, you know, that we had, like, you know, like, or even when we're something as simple as watching news, right? Like, you don't, the scene where you happen to turn on the television and a news story is playing, that doesn't really happen anymore. Like, news is so intentional now. And, you know, you have to look for that story. And now the only places where news comes to you is through something like social media, where, you know, I just want a cat video and all of a sudden I hear about the war and blah, 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 or something like that. So for me, it wasn't like, how do I make the news technology current? It was more just like, how do I have what is in media more reflective of like what we're actually sort of seeing and this sort of new way that we consume news. And so for then, I think a little bit of the pressure that you're talking about was off. It was just more like, how have we been consuming it lately? And for better or worse, this is how we're consuming it, you know? And it reminds me of, again, nowhere near in the same league, but it felt like the first time I saw the news in a comic book was in Dark Knight Returns, where you had political commentators talking about it. And there was that integration of like, oh, superheroes and the real world. Like, yeah, political pundits would talk about Batman and all that kind of stuff. And it was more, not that we're doing anything on the level of Dark Knight Returns, but it was just a little bit of that spirit of, yeah, how do you just make this a little bit more, in a weird way, media in comics, I felt, not certainly not across the board, but a little bit feels like it's still a little stuck in the shadow of Dark Knight Returns, where everyone's just like tuning on the TV. And I think we'd be a better world if we all watched more like TV news, but we don't. And that's not how the world is anymore. So it was a little bit of like, how do we just make more, again, part of what the job of the Absolute Universe was to make everything more modern. It was also, how do we just modernize it to our current consumption of news?
Yeah. Raphael, Pornzag was mentioning that you knew that you wouldn't cross the standards and practices line when you were doing this. How do you know that? How do you know that fine line? And did you pull back at all as you were doing this? Was there a spot you were like, I can't quite go there?
I'm not sure I understood the question. I'm sorry.
Like, we were talking about getting the book not going too far with any violence or anything, so it wouldn't be approved by the standards and practices or the
right. No, I think it's much more about the efficiency of telling the story than, you know, being scared of shocking people or anything. I don't really mind about showing blood or anything, but by my experience, especially from American Vampire and other horror things, is that creating expectation through the pages tends to be more efficient to impact the reader than actually showing stuff. That works for pretty much everything, but especially in horror books. And my theory is that if you don't show anything, if you just suggest what's going to happen, whatever the reader imagine is going to be scary. If I eventually suggest something in a page, if I eventually draw something in a page, I might be I might be not as good as what they might expect. You know what I'm saying? So my chance to disappoint is bigger if I draw whatever is in my mind than if I just suggest and let them to think whatever they find scary. So that's my trick, let's just say.
I have a couple of logistical questions for you. Pornsack, you mentioned 6 issues, and we'll see. This is an ongoing series, and I know nothing is sure in the industry, but how far reaching is the plan at this point? Or how far are you hoping to go, as far as they'll take you, basically?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I, much like criminals, I am a cowardly superstitious. I'm a lot of cowardly and superstitious. So I have ideas and ambitions, but right now it's about these 6 issues. If I think too far ahead, I'm worried I'm going to jinx myself. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of ideas, but I have made a point to not bring any of those ideas into each other's orbit, into anything that looks like a story, because that feels like jinxing things. Mm. So right now we have a 6-issue story we're going to tell, and we're going to see how it goes. But if we were to get more, there are definitely a ton of ideas that I a lot of the way the book was designed was it was kind of setting up this little, I don't know, mini universe within a universe kind of thing, and say, hey, guys, we're done. If you want to play with any of these toys that we've set up, feel free. We set up a lot of toys for you to play. I have some ideas of how I play with those toys if I get the opportunity to play with those toys, but the job was really to set up all these toys for you guys if you want to play with them at all. And so that's kind of, you know, I have ideas. We introduce a lot of toys by the end of the 6 issues, and I have ideas on how to play with all of them. And then it's just a question if I get to be the one so lucky as to play with those toys.
Well, let me ask you a question that I don't know if you can answer about where those toys might go next. I know that Jason Aaron is writing the Absolute Universe event that's coming up in the fall. Is it too early to include these characters, or will we possibly see Absolute Green Arrow, Dinah, somebody like that pop up there?
You can't see it, but there are a ton of like red sniper dots that have like all sort of
all. Yeah, it's all the Marie second Javins you mentioned like ceiling.
As soon as you mentioned the word crossover Jason, I was just like, oh no, there are dots everywhere now. Anywhere I go, I will get sniped. Yeah, no. For the sake of my life, I unfortunately cannot mention anything about the crossover because I don't have it. Because I am not the one. Jason is the one writing it, and I'm not the one writing it. Yes. That's my answer. I'll stick it.
Though, I know they have this whole like writers' room thing going on. Have you been able to?
Yeah. They're great over there. Yeah. They're great. It's such a collab. I am so impressed and in awe of what Scott and DC Editorial has sort of set up, because it is a universe. We all talk to each other. And yet again, like, you would think because of that, there would be a lot of, oh, you've got to do this an issue to set up that. And then there's none. Like, me and Rafa are making the book we want to make, and it runs in sync with this universe. And occasionally we can throw a ball over the wall or the ball over the net, and it comes back at us. But again, it's like the Absolute Evil piece of it. People automatically assume, because they read Absolute Evil number one, that it was that DC and the guys in the Absolute Universe came to us and like, we killed Oliver Queen. What do you want to do anything with it? Like, that was an organic outgrowth of what B and Rafa was working on. And they decided to fold it into Absolute Evil. And it worked so well, you just assume it was a directive we were given. Mm-hmm. You know, the way the Absolute Universe works is so organic in that way. It really just allows us to kind of create, but at the same time, in an additive way where, you know, a toy we have here can be used there and a toy they have here can be used here. It really is a fantastic, working environment.
Well, and I think it sounds like from everything that we've heard from people and talked to people about, this is probably the not so secret sauce that is making DC really work right now, that it feels like it's led by creative decisions and writer and artist decisions first, rather. Yeah. Obviously, there's business decisions that come into it, but as a reader, that's what I want to see. I want to see you guys fly and tell the story you're going to tell.
It's a fascinating like sort of cycle when you're looking at the history of corporate storytelling, where it's always the same thing that leads to the Renaissance, right? It's always, hey, let creators do what they want to do. Give them freedom. Things go really well. They get to a point where corporate is just kind of like, all right, now we need to control this, because if we give the power, or if we give this, if we have our profits and losses connected to people that technically isn't on our payroll, isn't on our like W-2, then like this is bad. So then we need to find a way to control it. The popularity and sales always go down. And then within a couple of years, they make the same discoveries like, oh, maybe we should let creative people have more control. Let's take a chance and see what's happened. Even though that is literally the cycle of like this corporate entertainment, it's always the same thing. It's always like, you know, corporate people just suddenly discover like, here's a crazy idea, guys. Let's let creators create, just see what happens.
Yeah.
Just a suggestion, but if you have a problem with the executives, bow and arrow, you could take it out.
I don't know. Alex really pushing for a serial killer to come out of this interview.
Specifically me.
Exactly.
Whoever. I'm just throwing it out there.
It's your ideas. Zoom. He's pitching them back to you for a sec.
Just to sort of wrap it up here with the book, again, I'll mention that it's coming out May 20th from DC. It's great. Everybody should pick it up. But anything you want to tease? I know we've talked about some aspects of the book, but anything in particular you want to mention, either about the first issue or the first arc, to tease people and let them know why they should pick this up?
Oh, God. Let's see. Comes out May 20th. If you don't know it by now, or if you haven't picked it up along the way, It is about a serial killer slaughtering corrupt billionaires, and the only clue to their identity are the green arrows he leaves in the bodies of his victims, a clue, a message to his very rich, very powerful enemies that you can't get away with Oliver Queen. It is I Know What You Did Last Summer for Billionaires, and it follows Dinah Lance. Oh, thank you. It follows Dinah Lance, Black Canary, as she has been tasked to uncover the identity of this killer. All our suspects, DC fans will recognize as archers from the DC universe. And it is a violent horror slasher book. But also, I think, too, it's a book about, I don't know, it's a book about anger and what to do with that anger. And hopefully it will be cathartic in some ways, but hopefully it will also be, well, hopefully it'll be cathartic in two different ways. To unleash some of that sort of energy that I think people are responding to, but also as a conversation of just about like what to do with the energy that we have, this pent up energy that we have. And that's certainly how I'm looking at it.
and buy the single issues before the corporate hand comes slice it up.
You never know. You really never know.
I love that's my that's a great takeaway from this interview.
Pornsack Raphael, thank you so much for coming on. Again, absolute pleasure. No pun intended. I'm looking forward to reading the rest of the book. I said it accidentally, so I had to
put that in the pocket. That's a key.
Thank you very much.
Thank you guys.
Thanks, guys.
This is fun.